It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to the Annie E. Casey Foundation, 17% of children in Pennsylvania are living in poverty. That's actually down from 19% nearly a decade ago. This year, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette has spotlighted child poverty in the Pittsburgh region in a year-long series, Growing Up Through the Cracks. Joining us in studio are reporters Kate Giamarisi and Rich Lord, as well as photographer Michael Santiago. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks for having us.
When you began this project, what was it that you were trying to explore through your stories? Rich, we'll start with you.
Yeah, we wanted to figure out kind of where to put our resources, our time and effort, and how to focus on the communities that really needed the most attention and the most help. And we were looking for kind of the way to measure that. And we settled on child poverty as both a way to get at the overall level of, I guess, distress in a community, and also to get at the human cost, because these kids obviously didn't decide to be in poverty. When we kind of sorted the data, we found that, child poverty in our county isn't particularly higher than it is nationally, but there are areas in which half or more, sometimes up to 60 or 65% of the kids are living in poverty. And if you talk to the experts, they'll tell you that that brings a whole host of problems. That brings, abandoned houses, messed up infrastructure, crime, lack of educational attainment. And even if your family in particular is not in poverty, you know, your kid is going to be affected by that, surrounded by it.
Kate, when you got involved at the start of this project, what was it that you as a reporter wanted to touch upon?
So I think with these stories, we've been trying to do like good people stories where we're talking about people and people affected by this problem. But we're also kind of trying to highlight some policy issues. And, you know, along with that concentrated poverty, we have this kind of particular issue locally of we have like a very highly fragmented system of local government. And I don't want to say that that makes it concentrated poverty worse, but it certainly doesn't help.
Michael, what interested you about being involved in this project?
For me, it was just to highlight the issues in a way that can show people how this affects everyone. I think that as a photographer and seeing images throughout history and all the studying that I did for other photographers, people have a sense of what poverty looks like from images of the past through the FSA program in the early 20s and 30s and 40s. But not realizing that people who live in poverty look like everybody else. They think because someone lives in poverty, they should look a certain way. And that's not necessarily the case. And that was truly important for me to be a part of this, and just to show what poverty actually really looks like and how people look.
What does it mean to live in poverty, especially for a child?
It means not only, obviously, not having the resources that most of us have, not having sometimes the ability to find a good meal on a non-school day. You know, there's the basics, but there's also the feeling of walking out of your house, and rather than seeing a neighborhood in which there's a certain level of civic pride, a certain assumption about public safety, but to have to walk from your home to daycare past abandoned buildings, to have to worry about whether there's going to be a shooting or drug dealing outside of the place in which you spend your day, whether that's a school or a daycare center or a community center.
What communities have you focused on to this point, and how were they selected, Kate?
So we selected the communities based on, I think, was it census data, Rich? And so far we have taken a look at Rankin, Wilmerding, North Braddock, Duquesne, and McKeesport. In Fayette County, Salt Lake Township.
So you didn't limit yourself to Allegheny County. There was obviously plenty of examples of concentrated poverty within Allegheny County. What made you go to Fayette County?
We wanted to be regional about this because we do think that just capturing kind of the poverty in the Mon Valley or in a couple of South Hills or Rivertown communities or even like the Mount Olivers of the world is not enough. We do have rural poverty in our region out in Fayette County. We do have these even more isolated places in Armstrong and Westmoreland County in which well over half of the kids are living in poverty. You get a different, I guess, broader picture, especially literally picture, as Michael has captured, of what it looks like.
What similarities, maybe shared circumstances, are there in the stories of the children, their families, whether they live in Rankin or McKeesport or any of the other communities they mentioned? Did you see any common threads?
I think one of the biggest things that I saw is the lack of resources that are available to individuals, like the food programs. A lot of these kids now who are in school, most of the times the only meals they get is when they go to school. So when you're outside of school during the summer, where are you going to eat?
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about childhood poverty in the Pittsburgh area with the Post-Gazette's Kate Giammarisi, Rich Lord, and Michael Santiago. A most recent story in the series profiles Rebecca Bridges, a mother who moved her family of four kids from McKeesport to Glassport to find opportunity. How would you say her experience fits into the overarching storyline of the series? Okay.
You know, I first met Ms. Bridges at the Family Support Center in McKeesport. I had interviewed a number of moms there about what were some of their challenges of, you know, living in McKeesport. And she was very open to sharing her story and sharing, opening up about her family situation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she had a problem that is kind of common to people living in poverty, which is that she is working, she works really hard, but she just wasn't earning enough money to get by. Mm-hmm. And also, because she works in, it's sort of a unique paradox of, she works in the childcare field, which is, childcare is very expensive, but yet people working in that field typically don't earn a lot of money. So that was something that I thought was very interesting to highlight with her story.
In terms of how to present the project, what's the reasoning behind the multimedia setup, the presentation of text, images, illustration, data, more components to form the story? Michael, let's start with you.
I think one of the biggest reasons for that, and one of the, is because sometimes people want to see more than words, and I think that pictures, you know, they tell the story within themselves. Sometimes people actually, it's one thing for people to read something that's happening and for them to actually see it, mm-hmm, and with their own eyes. And I think that plays a lot into what we're doing.
Well, Michael, then, how did you specifically want to explore poverty through your photography?
I wanted to show it in a way that shows these families live exactly like everyone else, except that they don't have the means that they do. For example, like with the prior story of Rebecca Bridges, like, you know, her kids have all these toys. These are things that sometimes, you know, you think that only certain families can afford afford certain toys. Well, every kid should have toys. I wanted to absolutely just show the families as normal as possible, that they're exactly like everyone else.
Yeah, I want to add one other component. We have an illustrated component here, too. We have an illustrator, Stacey Innerst, who's doing graphic novel presentations, mm-hmm, of the stories we find. We wanted a set of images, a set of materials that would appeal to anyone from a teenager to a senior.
Kate?
Well, yeah, I think with a lot of these stories, the photos are extremely integral part of this journalism, and they really capture what we can't convey with words. For instance, in the most recent story, like, I think Michael's photos of the kids just totally capture their energy and just their, you know, playfulness of kids. But also with that online presentation for some of the stories where people can sort of scroll in a way that the photos are very prominent. I mean, I think that kind of is signaling to readers, like, hey, this is a really important story.
How much access did you have in talking with the children themselves to get their sense, their impression?
A lot. I'll be honest. We've had some doors slammed in our faces in the course of this story, but we've also spent, for instance, in the upcoming story, hours and hours in a daycare center, which happens to be in a very violent and difficult hotspot. And for instance, worked closely with an 8-year-old girl who goes to that daycare center. A minority, but a meaningful minority of parents and families have been just extremely open in trying to show the world the challenges their communities face.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about childhood poverty in the Pittsburgh area with the Post-Gazette's Rich Lord, Michael Santiago, and Kate Giamarisi. Allegheny County has 130 municipalities. How does just the volume of disparate communities and how they're structured impact poverty in terms of shared services?
Well, one thing that one of our stories looked at with one of our particular communities is that it's in Act 47 status, which is the state right. designation for like a distressed community. And our story really tried to examine if this is helpful. You know, from what a lot of folks said, it's actually not very helpful. And the state or the county can't really compel communities to share services. That's something that's often discussed, but it doesn't get done very often.
Michael, how did you, through your photography, present, whether you went to community facilities or whatever, the idea of the impact, the importance of services to these individuals, to these families, these kids?
Like say for the McKeesport story, the Family Resource Center, it's a place that's vital for families in the area. Mm-hmm. You know, it has places where computers, where mothers can go in, and you know, if they're doing school, they could do online school there. They can do fill out job applications there while their kids are being taken care of by individuals. So, you know, places like that have those kind of resources are extremely vital for families.
The reporting by your team, looking at the communities we've mentioned to this point, but you didn't just limit to that. You went elsewhere. Louisville, Kentucky, for example. I know, Michael, you were involved in that story and obviously the images.
Yes.
A word that struck me in that reporting was compassion agenda.
Yes, that's one thing that, you know, when it came to either the issues revolving on family and childhood poverty to homelessness, compassion was one thing that was a really big in the things that they did. But they had a program for single mothers and also single families where if you are approved to it, you can move into sort of like campus-like setting mm-hmm. where they help you to go to school and get your degrees. They have child care as well for your kids as well. So, and what the goal is that is after you're done and you complete your college degrees, you can move on and buy your own house and live in a meaningful way. It's a way to, it's kind of like almost a startup program to the American dream in a way. And their goal is to make people financially secure towards the end of the program.
In your research for this initiative, are there solutions we could learn from other cities, other locations to adapt to what's happening here in the Pittsburgh region? Rich?
Yeah, Louisville's been the first that we've kind of detailed in that they have a united city-county government that can bring resources to bear where they're needed. And they also have a leader, their mayor, Greg Fisher, who has, as you said, embraced a compassion agenda, so really made this a top public priority. We're also looking at what's happening in Utah, where they've found ways to use data to find families that are in intergenerational poverty and try to lift them out of it. And we're even looking internationally at places that have made the reduction or almost the elimination of child poverty a national priority. So we'll be getting to that in the coming months.
What do you wish others in Western Pennsylvania understood better about their less affluent neighbors? Okay.
Yeah, I think, you know, hopefully the stories really highlight just the disparity of resources here in Allegheny County and that there's some communities that have quite a lot and some communities that just have very little.
Rich?
Just that these are kids. I mean, they're no different from my kids, your kids, anybody else's kids. They want to be able to go outside and to play and not to be surrounded by abandonment and blight and not to be threatened by crime. And they have entered into these circumstances through no fault of their own. And if we don't really have maybe the willpower to dedicate resources to addressing adults in poverty, we should certainly think about whether we want, you know, further generations to grow up with these disadvantages.
what I want people to take from this is that not everybody can just get up and move out of poverty. It doesn't happen that way and that fast. People are often one emergency away from being homeless, and I think it's about time that people start realizing that.
What's next for the series, either immediately or during the course of the remainder of the year?
Definitely a couple more communities that we are hoping to highlight before the end of the year.
I mean, you've got places like North Braddock, where we'll be reporting in late July, in which they have something like 400 abandoned homes, and they have enough money, because they're a small borough, to tear down one or two per year. When you have that level of abandonment and that low level of resources, you're basically precluding folks from moving in who might set a different economic tone or a different educational tone. So I think we're getting a better understanding of the kind of poverty trap that exists as a result of our fragmentation than we had ever imagined.
Rich Lord, Kate Giamarese, Michael Santiago are journalists at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. We'll have a link to their series, Growing Up Through the Cracks, on our website, WESA.FM. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. The CDC estimates that nearly 2% of children in the U.S. are autistic. A Pitt researcher found that 15% of furries, people who create anthropomorphized versions of themselves, fall somewhere on the autism spectrum. We'll take a look at this research. Then, Governor Wolf has ordered a $90 million bond issue to help Pennsylvania counties pay for new, more secure voting machines. But it's not clear whether that order is within the governor's executive authority. And when will Allegheny County start seeing these new machines? Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at WESA.FM/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the life-size fiberglass model Dippy is unveiled in front of the Carnegie Library Complex in Oakland in 1999. The 22-foot-tall dinosaur commemorates the 100th anniversary of an expedition financed by Andrew Carnegie in the Badlands of Wyoming. During that trip, the team discovered a nearly complete fossil skeleton of the Diplodocus. Dippy the sculpture is often decorated for holidays or important sports events. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Furries are people who create anthropomorphized versions of themselves. A Pittsburgh-based researcher has found that up to 15% of furries surveyed have autism spectrum disorder. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that nearly 2% of children in the U.S. are autistic. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden went to Anthrocon, one of the world's largest furry conventions, to report on possible reasons why autism is more prevalent in this community.
The convention takes place annually in downtown Pittsburgh. This year, it had more than 9,000 attendees. At the convention, people go to workshops on how to move in costume, join meetups for Christian, atheist, or pagan furries, and attend a parade, which was hot and crowded.
Everyone's trying to kind of maneuver around each other. This is the kind of thing that seems like it would be incredibly difficult for a person on the spectrum.
Duquesne University's Elizabeth Fine has been researching furry culture for 4 years.
A shark! Oh, look at the shark! Look at the shark!
Most people at Anthrocon wear street clothes, often along with ears or tails. If they have the money, some commission full suits, which are made from plastic, fake fur, and foam rubber. Furry costumes often resemble Disney or anime characters. They're technicolor with big, cute eyes.
So what I love are all the different expressions on the faces. Some of them are just wide-eyed, big smile.
Others have a creepy vibe.
Like a little toothy, you know, a little bit of a jagged, toothy grin.
Fine specializes in psychological and psychiatric anthropology, as well as neurodevelopmental conditions like autism. She says fursuiting offers lots of benefits for autistic people. Travis Lukowski of Gettysburg says that's the case for him.
When I'm wearing the full suit in the head, I feel like I don't have to be me.
Today, he's dressed as Silva, an icy blue Arctic saber cat.
I'm the character I'm trying to portray instead. So in a way, it's like a break from the anxiety and stress.
Lukowski says he was diagnosed with autism while in middle school. Lots of people on the spectrum struggle to read social cues or make eye contact. Fine says she's been told by research volunteers that communicating in suits and masks is easier.
You can express a lot of emotion in a fursuit, for sure, but it tends to be larger and more considered gestures.
Another reason Lukowski says he likes fursuiting is that it feels comfortable, even in hot July temperatures.
The full suit is very sensory for me because it's like I'm like wrapped around just like a big, giant, like warm carpet-like hug.
Many autistic people find it soothing to use a weighted blanket or wear heavy clothing. Also, it's harder to hear or see in a fursuit. Fine says autistic people are often overwhelmed by loud noises and bright lights.
The suits kind of cut that down. They sort of dull the input.
Lukowski and Fine point out that autism also comes with strengths. Many on the spectrum are particularly honest, logical, and artistic. Fine and her collaborators collect much of their data through surveys and focus groups during conventions like AnthroCon. I chat with Camille Zugarek of Luzerne County as she looks over the survey. Her furry persona is named Rizzo.
And it's a mountain goat.
Why a mountain goat?
Because they're energetic, loud, and obnoxious, and that's totally me.
Zugarek doesn't mention autism, but does explain why she likes furry culture.
I like that it's like super accepting and there's no judging here, and I think that's why I stay in it.
That welcoming atmosphere is something many furries mention. Most of them know it might seem strange to wear a tail to the grocery store or spend the weekend dressed as a pink fox. That doesn't matter when they're part of a menagerie, which might be the biggest reason so many furries are on the spectrum. Travis Lukowski says being a furry and meeting other furries has helped him accept himself.
I was bullied a lot growing up, and then when I found out I was autistic, my depression hit a lot harder because I always thought that was a bad thing. But finding the fandom, I learned that it wasn't a bad thing. It was just me.
Lukowski says there's nothing wrong with him. He just thinks differently. I'm Sarah Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Governor Tom Wolf ordered a $90 million bond issue to help Pennsylvania counties pay for new, more secure voting machines just a day after vetoing a separate bill that promised to do the same thing. Wolf says he vetoed the measure because it included a provision inserted by Republican leaders to end straight party ticket voting options. But it's not clear whether this bond order is within the governor's executive authority. We're here with investigative reporter Mike Wershagen of the Caucus to talk about where we go from here with the new voting machines. Mike, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thanks for having me.
Mike, what brought the issue of outdated voting machines to the forefront originally?
It was actually a lawsuit that was an outgrowth of the 2016 election. Green Party candidate Jill Stein had sued the state over its election systems. And as part of a settlement that the state of Pennsylvania entered into with Jill Stein's campaign and with a few other Pennsylvania voters, the state agreed to do a few things to sort of upgrade its systems, one of which was to replace all of its voting machines in every county by the 2020 election and replace them with machines that actually created a paper trail, so that when you were going to do an audit or you're doing a recount to try to check the results of an election, you can actually go back to a paper copy. The way that Allegheny County's machines work, for instance, if you want to do a recount, the machine just spits out the same numbers it spit out before. So what this was aiming to do was to sort of set up a more robust system to check the results. And, you know, it took on some added importance after the 2016 election when we found out through the intelligence community, the U.S. intelligence community, that, you know, Russian hackers had attempted to penetrate election systems in these states. We know that, you know, these foreign governments are probing these systems. And so this is one way to make the system more secure and make the elections a little more let people have more faith in the elections.
That they're more assured that the person that they think they cast the ballot for is actually registered as getting that vote.
Exactly.
All right. So where was the money going to come from originally to help the counties pay?
Well, it's a little bit different this year than the last time that counties replaced their voting machines. The last time it was 2004, 2005-ish, and it was spurred by the Help America Vote Act, which was an act passed by Congress. This is a federal law. Mm-hmm. And the federal law said, we'll pay for everything. This time, this is a settlement only in Pennsylvania with the courts. And so the money is coming from the counties, but it's also the state had agreed or had promised to kick in. Governor Wolf is suggesting that about 60%, as much as 60% of counties' costs will be picked up or reimbursed by the state.
Did Republican leaders in this appropriations measure that the governor wound up vetoing, did they actually insert more money than he asked for? I mean, so they were willing to go along with the money.
Right. The money was not the issue here. And this is something that it makes this debate a little bit different than a lot of other debates we have in Harrisburg. Everybody seems to be on the same side when it comes to at least the issue of money, because we're talking about all 67 counties. That means every representative, every state senator, they all have skin in this game, and they're all going to have to answer to some pretty angry people if they don't get this money over to the counties.
So the appropriation was vetoed, so the governor did a bond issue, which is just borrowing money to pay for it, or what?
Well, he hasn't done the bond issue yet. He announced yesterday that that's what he's going to be pursuing, and we're still in the very early stages there. The bond issue and whether it actually can be debt is, believe it or not, a legal question that's kind of up in the air right now.
And we're going to talk about that in just a little bit. What does the governor's action mean for one of those 67 counties, Allegheny County? The Confluence's Megan Harris spoke with County Executive Rich Fitzgerald late yesterday.
So, County Executive, I'm curious, from your perspective, how will this bond issue play out, at least here in Allegheny County?
Well, it'll be very helpful. And the fact is that the governor made that commitment that he, number one, wants to have more secure voting machines in all 67 counties, but that the Commonwealth was not just going to have counties be kind of left trying to fund it, but that the Commonwealth, that the state would be providing a significant amount of funding. And I think he's moving forward with that today. And the announcement that he made is well received.
It seems like it's not clear yet whether this bond order is technically within the governor's executive authority. So what happens here in Pittsburgh if it turns out that this isn't something that can actually go forward?
Well, I mean, I think the governor's committed one way or the other, and I think he's looking at this avenue, and I think they'll go through the process within the Commonwealth statutes, et cetera. But I think the governor's, and I've heard his comments, he was on the radio today talking about his commitment to make sure that counties aren't left without the funding to make this happen. So I think one way or the other, the governor's been committed to making sure that this occurs.
It sounds like you're pretty confident in the governor's promise to make it happen somehow. At the moment, what is the status of voting machines here in Allegheny County?
Well, they've had the some of the public displays that have occurred throughout the county. I think over a numerous, like almost a 2-week period. So a lot of folks were able to go and look at the. I think there's 4 machines that the state has certified as they go through that process. And I think the election department and the committee that was put together are evaluating as to what goes on. But I don't know how close they are to making any kind of a recommendation or a decision.
Have you checked them out yourself?
I did. I went to one of the facilities out at our CCAC South Campus and got to see all the machines, got to get to play with them a little bit and see how they worked. And they all have different pluses and minuses. And I think a lot of people got a chance to see, number one, how easy are they to use? Number two, how secure are they? And how, you know, the paper verified part of it that I think so many folks wanted to see and that the state has put into their policy, the Department of State. So, they look pretty good, to be honest with you.
What's the prognosis then? Say we select one, we're happy with it. How quickly can those get rolled out into every precinct that we need here in Allegheny County?
That I'm not sure of, because I don't know how many machines we would have to buy. It depends, I guess, on which system is put into place. There's 1,300 polling places in Allegheny County, many with multiple machines. I think we have over 4,000 machines right now that are in place on the older system. So there will be a significant learning curve, both from, you know, installing the machines, but also from the folks who have to turn them on in the morning and have them up and running and tabulating them later in the day. So that's always a process that isn't always easy. Sometimes it takes a couple of cycles for everybody to kind of really feel comfortable, but we'll make sure we have enough people out there from the election department. If we have to hire some extra people to do that, we'll do that. It'll be a change. And anytime there's a change, there's sometimes hiccups occur.
What kind of lead time do you think you need to have to train new poll workers and have everybody ready to go?
Oh, I don't know the answer to that. I really rely on the experts on that. But I think we would want to have a number of training sessions for people to feel comfortable, particularly the judges of elections in those 1,300 polling places. Many of them who have been working in the community for many years. They've been judge of elections for many years. And so they're folks that have a good sense and really are really great citizens to come out and do what they do. And I'm sure they'll delve in and dig in and learn the machines and how they operate and how to turn them on and how to make them easy for the voters to use.
Are you personally concerned about election security here in Pittsburgh?
It's always something you have to be a little concerned of. I'm very confident that over the last few years, we've been able to have a secure system that's been workable, and I'm sure moving forward, it's something we've got to always be diligent about, because there will be, you know, sometimes people will try to game the system, whatever system you have. So we've always got to make sure security is part of it, whether the machines are in a secure location, when the voting is done, that the votes are secured, and we make sure that people have confidence that the folks that they voted for or the votes that get tabulated.
What would you say to your fellow swing state voters who are maybe concerned watching this kind of go back and forth in the legislature?
Well, I would say just, you know, continue to follow it. Make sure you're reaching out to your representatives. There's other things in voting besides the machines, I think, that the governor would like to see. And I would concur with him. No excuse absentee balloting. I think he would like to see that occur. I think he would like to see early voting, which makes it more accessible and easier for folks to move forward. I think same day registration we should make voting easier and more accessible while making it secure as well.
Thank you so much, County Executive.
All right. Thank you. Have a good day.
That was The Confluence's Megan Harris. If you're just joining us, we're chatting with investigative reporter Mike Wershagen about how the Commonwealth's 67 counties will fund new, hopefully more secure, voting machines ahead of the 2020 election. So, Mike, the state providing up to 20% reimbursement of the cost of these new voting machines. You also spoke with Rich Fitzgerald. Has the county sort of set aside any money in this year's budget for their share to pay for the machines?
There is no line item in the county budget for this. As you said, they're looking to the state for as much as 60% of this money to come back, but they don't know what it's 60% of yet, because they don't know which machines they're getting, and which machines they get is going to be, you know, is going to dictate how much they end up spending on these things. As the county executive said, Allegheny County has 4,700 voting machines. Now, that's spread over 1,300 polling places. Depending on the system you go with, you might not need 4,700 machines. The county spokeswoman, Amy Downs, had said that if you have something like an optical scanner, you might only need one for some of these polling places. So it's a real open question right now, how many of these or how much this is all going to cost.
The appropriation measure that was vetoed to help the counties pay for the machines was sort of nixed by the governor because of a provision added on to it to end straight party voting. How did that issue get wrapped up in a bill about voting machines?
Does anything get wrapped up in anything in Harrisburg? Somebody wanted to make this a priority. Somebody wanted to push this issue forward, and they did. Pennsylvania is only one of nine states that allows straight ticket voting. Hmm. That's going to drop to eight in 2020 when a law that Texas passed goes into effect. So this became, you know, sort of a partisan division when this was inserted into this bill in Pennsylvania.
So why do Republicans want to get rid of it, and why do Democrats, Wolf, Rich Fitzgerald, others, want to keep it?
Well, Republicans say that they want this provision in there because it will lead to a more engaged citizenry, a more engaged voting process where you're actually picking candidates. You're not just voting based on party. You're voting based on who you think would be the best person to fill the office. Democrats say they see this as sort of a way to depress Democratic turnout, a way to take votes away from Democrats. And they also worry that this is going to have some real effects on turnout.
Is there any evidence that one party benefits by straight ticket voting?
There is evidence that one party gets more votes that way, I would say, is the way to put it. So Democrats in the 2018 election got about 33% of their votes in Allegheny County through straight party tickets. That was 283,000 votes. Republicans got just 17.5%, good for about 96,000 votes. So a little more than half of what Democrats did. Now, 2018 was a wave election. It was an election driven by a lot of people who just wanted to show up and kind of voice their displeasure with the president and with his party. And so you had, you know, this very motivated Democratic base turnout. But even in elections past, you still have Democrats getting 20-25% of their votes through straight party tickets and Republicans getting between 8-15% through the same process.
We have just a couple minutes left. Was the veto a surprise or not?
Not really. Once this issue was inserted into the reimbursement bill,
right,
things got pretty heated. I mean, the votes passing that bill went down almost strict party lines in Harrisburg. There were a few Democratic defections, but they mostly held together. So this became a real partisan flashpoint.
So the governor ordered the bond issue to help pay for the machines. There seemed to be some question as whether he actually has the executive authority to do so. Are you hearing anything about any challenges to that order?
I'm hearing that people are looking at the possibility of challenges. And there are some people who seem to think that, no, the governor does not have the authority to do this. And they point to the language in the law that created this bonding program, bonding authority,
right,
which was passed way back in, I think, 67s, I believe. And even to the Constitution, which places some limits or specifies when a governor may issue debt. There's a provision in there that says a governor can only do it when there's a disaster declaration. So this is still an open question, and I think we're going to see this litigated out over the next couple of weeks and who knows how long.
A House Appropriations Chair, Stan Saylor, is a Republican. He called the governor's action another example of executive overreach. So if they do a legal challenge and if the bond plan fails, what's next?
What's next is there's another bill sitting out there that's ready to roll. It's written by a Bucks County Republican named Gene DiGirolamo. He's a representative out in the eastern part of the state. And his bill has the $90 million in it. The $90 million is not disputed. Let's remember that. The $90 million is something everybody seems to agree on. So he wants to have this bill ready to go in case the governor's plan fails. You can just drop this right into the process and vote it through and the counties get their money.
And does he want the straight party ticket voting in a separate measure?
He wants the $90 million. So whatever gets that through is what we talked yesterday, and he said whatever gets that $90 million through, whatever gets this money to the counties, that's what he wants to see happen. And if the straight party ticket thing is going to sink it, he doesn't want it in there.
And in a sentence, is there a danger we won't have the machines by 2020 or we absolutely have to?
If we don't, we will be in violation of a settlement that the state entered into in court. So
I guess we'd be in violation. Mike Warshagen is a Pittsburgh-based investigative reporter for the caucus covering state government and politics. Mike, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, a new study indicates depression rates among older adults in the Pittsburgh region are dropping. Plus, the Pittsburgh Festival Opera this weekend will feature two one-act operas by none other than Fred Rogers. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.